about the restorationists and what happened with education in general. And yep, thank you.
Recording in progress.
We'll talk about the restorationists and what happened with education in general and with undergraduate and graduate education, college education in particular. We'll talk about a little bit about the distinction that began to be drawn between colleges and seminaries. When the early restorationists talked about seminaries, for the most part, they weren't talking about something that was exclusively religious. Now, it came to have that meaning, and that's the way we kind of refer to it today, but they used the word seminary to just mean a seed plot or a nursery. It was a place where you could learn and begin to grow and develop skills. So that's what we're going to talk about. Now, they were specifically concerned about the skills of ministers. I think everybody realizes that colleges like Harvard, Yale, some of the big Ivy League schools were established in the mid-1600s. And their purpose was to provide a general education that would prepare their students for any of the professions. Now, they generally speaking looked at the professions the same way that they've been looked at since the Middle Ages. Four professions were recognized: the law, medicine, the clergy, and teachers. Now, those, as far as they were concerned, that was what Harvard was trying to prepare their students for. Give them what they needed to be able to enter into any profession. They did not start out focusing on a liberal arts education like many of our universities do today. Liberal arts to them was pointless because in theory, what they were doing was preparing people for these professions. So they had structured classes, they had textbooks, they de-emphasized field work, and even though they were trying to prepare people to enter the ministry, trying to prepare people to become ministers, they also included secular classes. And basically, everybody took all of the classes that were offered. So they did have classwork in religious themes. They did have classwork in the law and in medicine. And if you were going to be, if you wanted to enter the profession of minister, you would take these preparatory undergraduate courses in law and medicine. Well, there was another model for training. The other model didn't have structured classes. They tended not to have textbooks, and they emphasized field work. This is the apprenticeship model. And this allowed a person who was thinking about entering a profession to, and specifically ministry, to learn about ministry under the leadership or the tutelage of an experienced person. They did study the Bible. They also studied classical literature. They studied classical languages. And these apprenticeship programs included on-the-job experience. Now, these apprenticeship programs to train people to be effective ministers characterizes most clearly my training as a minister. I went to Sunnyvale. I studied at Sunnyvale with the elders. We met together 3 days a week. I had a reading list that I had to go through. I had assignments. I was paid to preach. I wasn't paid to be a student. I was paid to preach alongside the fellow that was preaching there before I came. His name was Bill Cassio. And whenever I preached, the elders and Bill would critique my sermons. That was always a harrowing experience to have to go in Monday morning after I had preached on Sunday, because I knew right when I got to the office, I was going to get the knock on the door. Come on, let's go. And so that was an apprenticeship program. And that was the way that a lot of people were trained in the ministry. So when the Great Awakening comes along and you have these larger than life preachers, very prominent individuals who were unconnected with the colleges, they didn't go to school at Harvard or Yale or Princeton. Well, that tended to increase the appeal of the apprenticeship model. Now, it turns out that the apprenticeship model involved a conflict. Students could look at the person that they were apprenticing with, and this person is, like I said, he's larger than life. Think about being able to apprenticeship or to be an apprentice with Alexander Campbell or Barton W. Stone. These were people of great fame. And what happened was people wanted to apprentice and be like Alexander Campbell or Barton W. Stone or David Lipscomb a little bit later. Not that they wanted to be effective ministers, but they wanted to be famous. And revival meetings could be seen as a means to achieve self-gratification and a certain amount of notoriety. Now, the colleges observing all of this going on responded by creating post-baccalaureate, or after you had your bachelor's degree, you would attend theological seminaries. And at this point, seminaries and colleges started to be distinct institutions. So you would get your undergraduate degree, which was a general education that covered a lot of ground, and then you would specialize at the seminary. And one of the first seminaries that was started, theological seminaries as a graduate school, was Andover Seminary. And there's fascinating history to all of that. A Unitarian was appointed to be the president of Harvard University, which created this tremendous uproar among the people that had, the Congregationalists who had been involved in creating Harvard. And so a lot of those Congregationalists just up and left. The Harvard was in real serious financial trouble because they had appointed a Unitarian to be the president of Harvard University. And then you started to see professors of divinity appear at Ivy League schools. And these were professors of divinity in the undergraduate side. So that's where you get this notion of Bible chairs. Typically, a group would endow a chair at the university. That meant that they put up the funds that would provide for the salary that was drawn by the person that held that faculty position. There was some problem because they wanted their classes to be recognized as credit-bearing classes for the university, and the universities didn't want them to do that. The university said, if you're going to offer credit-bearing classes, then the whole university is going to get to have a say about what you teach in your classes. And so, you know, that kind of thing still goes on today. But it involved the entire faculty, some of which were unchristian or unchristian. That's not the way to say that. We're not Christians, making decisions about what was being taught in the Bible classes. Well, you can imagine that didn't sit well. The people that were endowing the chair withdrew their endowments, and it was a real mess. That happens anytime you get church or Bible-thinking people, Bible-directed people, who are trying to fit into the mold that non-Christian people have built. Today, it happens this way. Churches are asked by some governmental body, would you, for instance, be involved in helping to place adoptive kids? And the Catholics have become involved in adoption societies, adoption agencies. And then once the government says, we'll give you money if you'll be involved in that, it's not very long until the government says, you're going to do it our way. And you have seen Catholic social services get crossways with governments because governments wanted Catholic social services to place adoptive kids with same-sex couples. And the Catholic Church said, no, we're not going to do that. That violates biblical information about a mother and a father, and we're not going to do that. So in some cities, the whatever the governmental institution is, they've said, if you don't do it our way, we'll withdraw our funding. Well, the Catholic Church used that funding and built an institution around that funding. Now the funding gets taken away, or the threat that it's going to get taken away. And so there's a lot of tension. Best for the church to function as the church, to have nothing to do with outside agencies at all. But that's, I mean, that's what happens. So let's think about how Alexander Campbell viewed this whole effort to train ministers. And he was pretty much joined by Barton W. Stone, Thomas Campbell, other leaders of the Restoration Movement in the earliest stages. By the time we get to the second generation of leadership, and we're talking about Lipscomb and Harding, they didn't share this view. David Lipscomb was instrumental in starting Lipscomb University in Nashville, Tennessee. Harding, of course, established Harding University. But Campbell's view of education and how education should work led him to establish what he called the Buffalo Seminary. Now, I looked and looked and looked for why he called it the Buffalo Seminary. I have no idea. I don't even know where it was located, but he started it in 1818. And Campbell's view was that the graduate seminaries were nothing more than centers that created an indoctrinated clergy intent on serving themselves rather than serving the church. He was not fond of the seminaries. He felt like education was influenced by the biases of the professor. And that's true. Education is going to be influenced by the biases of the person who's delivering the education. There's no way around that. Now, in some senses, that doesn't have anything to do with Christianity. In other senses, it does. If you hired a Presbyterian, you got education from a Presbyterian bias. If you hired a Unitarian, you got education from a Unitarian bias. The Buffalo Seminary, when Campbell published the prospectus for the Buffalo Seminary in the Christian Baptist, he said that it was going to be non-sectarian and non-denominational. And importantly, if you attended the Buffalo Seminary, you had to pay your own way. Now, kind of the reason that that happened was because the American Education Society had been established by the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians. And the American Education Society existed to support seminary students during their course of study. So if you were going to be a Presbyterian minister, the Presbyterian Church, without hiring you to be a minister, would pay you a stipend while you were going to school. Now, you have to understand something very, very important about Alexander Campbell. Campbell never took pay for his preaching. In fact, he steadfastly refused it. He argued that a preacher ought to support himself by other gainful employment. Campbell's other employment was as a farmer and as a publisher. He published the Christian Baptist and the Millennial Harbinger. And he was one of the few people, remember when we talked about these papers, these journals? He was one of the few people that actually made a profit off of the publication efforts. But Campbell never took pay for his preaching. And in fact, in the prospectus for the Buffalo Seminary, he railed against the American Education Society, and he called the AES students kept men. He was dreadfully opposed to the notion that they should be supported while they were studying. Now, this is what he said in 1823. This will give you an idea of the way that he felt about these students. The Pittsburgh Recorder of November the 6th, 1823 informs us that 54 presbyteries of the General Assembly reported at the last meeting 132 beneficiaries, that is, poor, pious youth of talents, educated or assisted in obtaining an education. And this is where he starts this rant. By alms of the munificent devotees of the church, it informs us that the Philadelphia Education Society, organized in 1818, has since that time added 44 beneficiaries. It adds that the Presbyterian Education Society, which holds its annual meeting in the city of New York, existing for 5 years, is the most powerful institution of that kind in the United States, except for the American Education Society. Now, the Luminary, which was another paper that was published by the Presbyterians, of last July informs us that at the fifth anniversary of this society, 103 young men were reported on its list of beneficiaries. The aggregates of the poor, pious beneficiaries is 279. 279 young priests come. Yes, they come, meek and lowly, riding on the alms of the people, the colt of the asses of Judah. Yes, and 200 more mighty men, riding in chariots, come to thine aid. O Zion, thy mammon is thy glory. He was not impressed. So when he started the Buffalo Seminary, it was to counter what was going on with these kept men. In other words, you were paid to go to school and you will study what we tell you to study. You will learn what we tell you to learn. You will not entertain the notions of men like Alexander Campbell, no matter how well thought out they may be. You will not pay attention to it. And these young men didn't, because that was how they were living. So Campbell listed four powers that could be used to attain knowledge: instinct, sensation, reason, and faith. All of those were important. It's not just by reading the Bible, but the Bible is a source of knowledge. Instinct, sensation, and reason also played a role in this. The second point that Campbell made, and it was a point that he made often in the pages of the Christian Baptist, was that education is for everyone. It's not something that ought to be undertaken only by those that were interested in becoming ministers. Third point that he made, education should provide the moral foundation of character. So there was character education that was included at the Buffalo Seminary. He says it this way. The searching, examining, comparing, and ruminating on the Holy Scriptures in private, in the family, in the congregation, cannot fail to make us learned in the knowledge of God and in the knowledge of man. The Bible contains more real learning than all the volumes of men. It instructs us all in our natural, moral, political, and religious relations. I should mention Campbell served for a time as a member of the Virginia legislature. And he argued that that was a reasonable thing for him to do because biblical information informs political policy. The Bible does not, he continues this way, he says, though it, and that's the Bible, though the Bible teaches us not astronomy, medicine, chemistry, mathematics, and architecture, it gives us all that knowledge which adorns and dignifies our moral nature and fits us for happiness. Happy is the person who meditates upon it day and night. So he recognizes the value that can be found in the study of medicine. And the study of medicine is not based on faith. The study of medicine is based on sensation or what we can discover ourselves just looking at a human body. We could figure out how it works. Bible's not going to tell us that. That kind of education prepares doctors to be able to do what they do. So though he recognizes the value of education, and he recognizes the value of sensation or what we can discover just by looking at something, he also says that the Bible has to be there. And then he talked about the value of biblical studies. This is the fourth proposition that he often defended. He said the Bible should be the essential textbook for all schools and colleges. And this is what he said about the Buffalo Seminary, which later kind of morphed into Bethany College. He says, Bethany College is the only college known to us in the civilized world founded upon the Bible. It is not a theological school founded upon human theology, nor is it a school of divinity founded upon the Bible. It is a literary and scientific institution founded upon the Bible as the basis of all true science and true learning. So in Campbell's view, you didn't pursue education that was somehow to be within a biblical framework. You pursued biblical education And the other stuff came along. That's a different approach than what we see, generally speaking, even if we were to talk about York College, or we were to talk about Florida College, or Lipscomb, or Harding, or Texas Christian University, any of those institutions that have a biblical connection, argue that what you're getting is a broad general education that's in a framework that surrounds that education with a biblical perspective. And that was never what Campbell and Barton W. Stone and Thomas Campbell and even James O'Kelly, that was not what they wanted to see. They wanted to see Bible education. Not just for ministers, but for everyone. And he went so far as to say that sectarian education was a contradiction in terms. Sectarian education, in his view, is always provincial. If it's sectarian education that's provided by a Presbyterian, then it's sectarian education from a Presbyterian perspective. And his argument was sectarian education. If you let the various sects bias what you teach, then you're just promoting disunity. And he also argued for lifelong learning. Campbell felt like everyone should continue to be a learner throughout the entirety of their life. So, let's talk a little bit more about Campbell's view of paid preachers. And Campbell kind of stands as an important figure because he influenced so many people through the pages of the Christian Baptist and the Millennial Harbinger. And he was opposed to paid preachers. We'll see what he wrote in just a minute. Interestingly, Campbell said that if anybody was going to be paid, it ought to be the elders. He said, the bishop of a Christian congregation will find much to do that never enters into the idea of a modern preacher or minister. The duties he is to discharge, that's the elder, the duties the elder is to discharge to Christ's flock in the capacity of a teacher and president will engross much more of his time and attention than the minister. The idea of remuneration for his services was attached to the office from its first institution. And he quoted the Apostle Paul, saying, let the elders that serve well be counted worthy of double honor, especially those that labor in word and doctrine. He says, this was indisputably plain, not only from the positive commands delivered to the congregations, but from the hints that are uttered with reference to the office himself. And he talks about the elder should not take that position for filthy lucre. And he argues that if an elder could possibly entertain the idea of undertaking the office for filthy lucre, then there had to be some sense in which there was remuneration that was attached to the office. So that makes some sense. And he argues that if anybody should be paid, it should be the elders. Now, let it be said, I've only seen that happen in one place where I was aware of what was going on, and that was at Sunnyvale. They had four elders, three of whom were paid full-time. They were at the building every day. Now, let it be said that the congregation there had the financial wherewithal to undertake to do that, but the elders maintained an office at the building. They were there 9 to 5 or, 10 to 6 or 10 to 7, whatever, but they were there every day. They were paid to do the job of being elders. Then he says, deacons should be paid. And this is what he says. Deacons are those members of the church charged with keeping order. The concept of servant is most clearly established in the role of the deacon, for that is where the care for the property and prosperity of the congregation is lodged. Again, no education or specialized training will make one a deacon. However, broad classical understanding of history in the Bible will enhance the deacon's ability to care for the church. If the bishops are to teach the purity of faith, the deacons are to manage its order vis-a-vis the building in which that faith is exercised, the money which is contributed, and the elements which are consumed. The deacon's job is not to evangelize or convert, but to sustain those who have been converted. The office of a deacon is biblical, finds its authority in the Gospels through such servant figures as Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. He does not refer in this place to the group that I would have referred to, which are the seven men who were chosen in the first century church in Jerusalem to attend to the distribution of food to the needy Grecian or needy Hebrew widows or Grecian widows. This is what he says about preachers who are paid. A hireling is one who prepares himself for the office of a preacher or a minister as a mechanic learns a trade, and who obtains a license from a congregation, convention, presbytery, pope, or diocesan bishop as preacher or minister, and agrees by the day, the sermon, the month, or year for a stipulated reward. He intends to make his living in whole or in part by making sermons and prayers. And this is where he cuts to the chase, and he sets himself up to the highest bidder. So he argues that if you're a paid preacher, you're just a hireling, that you will not preach what needs to be preached because you don't want to lose your support. And remember, he felt that way about the kept men, the guys who were students, who were supported to study, to go to school. Not fond of paid preachers, not at all. And, we have decided typically that we would pay preachers, and yet we don't pay elders. Again, I've only seen one congregation that I know of that does that. There may be others, but that's the one that I know of that did that. I don't know of any that paid the deacons. even though the job that they do is so very important. So we have changed this. I don't see that there's biblical injunction against paying preachers. And Campbell really doesn't say there's a biblical injunction against it. He just felt like if you pay the preacher, he'll preach for money. And I would like to say that I've never done that, that has never entered my mind that I should not preach something because I would lose my support. But to be honest, it has entered my thinking. Now, I don't believe I've ever preached for money. And just like when I was involved in secular work, I never succumbed to the pressure to do something that my employer wanted me to do. And I've lost jobs because of it. Now, this was his view of the laity. He uses this term in contradistinction to the clergy. This is the common folks that worship at a particular congregation. These are not the preachers, they're not the elders, they're not the deacons. This is the common folks who worship at a particular place. He said, there's more value, he used to say, in one human being than there is in a million worlds such as we inhabit. He expressed a love of government where all enjoyed equal rights and his dislike of clerical domination. He said the true clergy are the Lord's people. God made men, the priests make laymen. That's a loaded phrase there. God made men, the priests make laymen. Man is the creature of God. A layman is the creature of priests. So it's just interesting to see how far we have come. Campbell never advocated that those people who are going to be ministers or preachers should not pursue education. Nor did he advocate that the only people that should be preaching are those who have a divinity degree. In fact, Campbell's model at a school that he later established called the School of Preaching, and I don't know too much about that. His model at the School of Preaching was that there would be 10 to 12 students who would live together every day. One of them would prepare a sermon and the rest of them would critique it. So his model for the effective training of preachers tended to be more the apprenticeship model than it was the seminary or college model, even though he established a seminary. So thoughts about education. course, you can see how these things kind of tend to play out in what happens in churches today. I know
we've had, that was me interrupting you, Jimmy. I know that we have classes for teachers, and we are, you know, they're trained to be preachers by the congregation that they're in, for a men's class or whatever. But you don't have to be a student of, like he said, intelligence. You just need to know the Bible. And if you're trained, it helps you to present your sermon, but you still teach the Bible.
Right. That in many ways, that's what Campbell would have argued.
Well, I wouldn't argue it so much, but I think that it's, you might be, if you're studying for somebody who doesn't teach just the Bible, if a university was teaching about something other than the Bible, that education is not wrong, but it would be wrong if they didn't teach the Bible. You know what I mean? Because they, well, in fact, I guess they have Methodist colleges and things like that. I don't know, but as far as I know, they do teach the Bible, the ones that carry the name.
Most,
that we know about.
Yeah, if you went to the University of Oregon, you would not find classes in the Bible. In fact, Bushnell University, which was started by some members of the Disciples of Christ, as I understand it, which is right downtown next door to the University of Oregon, they are familiar with this struggle, whether students at U of O who are matriculated at the University of Oregon come to Bushnell and take a course in Old Testament history, whether that course fulfills a requirement at the University of Oregon. And they fuss back and forth about whether that's going to work or not. And sometimes U of O has been accommodating. Sometimes they have not. And sometimes Bushnell is not very accommodating to students at the University of Oregon. But they maintain a
system. I can't remember the name. I should know it, but it's right downtown. And Kenneth went there and got a, it was a degree, but it was on religion. They took all kinds of classes. They studied the history and all of that, and he's qualified for that, but he went into a different field.
Right.
Of course.
Now that may have been.
And do have George Schwab, Northwest Christian, that's the name of it, of the college.
Oh, okay.
Or over by the university. Yeah.
As far as I understand, Northwest Christian has gone out of business.
Really? I did not know that.
Yeah, that was one of the things that happened while I was working for the state of Oregon. Somehow they lost their accreditation. I don't know everything about it. But colleges have a hard time attracting enough students to stay competitive.
Yeah.
And it happens all the time. Are you going to admit to your college people who do not share a biblical belief? And sadly, I don't know of any college who is in the habit of saying, everybody that plays basketball for our college shares our belief. If they need a big center, they make exceptions. And it's not just basketball, but that's where it plays out a lot of times. And you have to understand colleges are businesses.
That's true.
You have to attract students.
Yeah, but anybody went to Northwest Christian is what that's what they were interested in, and they didn't have basketball and so forth. But as you see, it dissolved apparently because it wasn't getting enough students or for whatever reason.
Wasn't attracting enough students. I attended the University of Redlands.
Yeah.
University of Redlands was originally established by the Baptists. Now, when I went to the University of Redlands, there was no Baptist association at all. When it first started, everybody had to go to chapel every morning at 7 o'clock. And if you didn't go to chapel, you couldn't go to another class all day long. I mean, they were serious about it. I know some Bible colleges still have chapel. They're not that serious that you have to go, but they offer chapel.
This has nothing to do with preaching, but I remember going to a Christian school, and every morning we had devotion and we said prayers and all sorts of things. But that was when I was little, and that's a long time ago. But they may still have things like that, but it's certainly not for preaching.
Yep. Yep. Well, basically, Christianity has been removed from the secular school system. When I went to school, in Kentucky, in elementary school, first and second grade, you had to repeat a memory verse from the Bible every day. My favorite verse is John, the 11th chapter, and verse 35. Jesus wept.
Mine was Acts 2:38, because I always remember he's got an axe and a gun, and he's coming right after you. It's Acts 2:38. But it is one of my favorite, I guess. But I see what you're saying.
I just liked it because it was short. Any other?
Yeah, I know.
Any other comments?
John 3:16.
Okay.
That's yours. That's good.
And Jesus wept.
Yep. Like I said, I did it because it was short. Just like I read what's the story about the old man in the sea? The old man that it's called The Old Man in the Sea. A real thin book. Every time I had to write a book report, I wrote it on The Old Man in the Sea. So you see these kinds of things play out today. This is still a question. I know a church right now who's looking for a preacher, and one of the things that they communicated that they were looking for was somebody that had at least an undergraduate divinity degree. And they preferred someone that had a master's degree. Not that I'm all that great, but that would have left me out. I couldn't apply for that.
Well, Paul didn't have a degree, and neither did any of the apostles or the other teachers, and really nothing has changed as far as the knowledge that you gain from the Bible.
Well, Paul's education was far and above what most graduate degrees are in this country.
Oh, yeah, that's studied true, but most of them were just
studied at the feet of Gamaliel. So, you know, Paul is not a good example to use of someone who was not educated, but was a very good preacher. Anyway, next week, I want to start talking about what's called the Lunenburg Letters. It was a lady in Lunenburg, West Virginia, that wrote to Alexander Campbell while he was publishing the Christian Baptist. No, it was in the Millennial Harbinger, and asked him about Christians in the sects. In other words, were there people that were worshiping with the Baptists who were Christians? And we'll talk about that a little bit, and then that will lead into the rebaptism controversy that raged in the early 1900s and continued until 1950 or so. And we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll start next week at 7 o'clock, and every time thereafter, we'll begin our Thursday night and Wednesday night at 7 o'clock rather than 7:30.